I've been unfancy for most of my life. But I had a curiosity question about Sacco and Vanzetti.
Yeah.
Like, you know, since Sinclair found out that they were guilty from a lawyer, but he didn't write it in his two-volume book, how do we know that?
Oh, 1960s. This was in a in his personal papers that were unpublished. It's the somebody letter. They call it the somebody letter. I don't know, somebody that he had written to privately or whatever. This was in his personal papers and then published fairly recently, and then became a matter of controversy long after his death.
Sure.
Wait a minute.
Everybody's going to remember him then because it's going to be stirred up. Okay. Thanks.
Barack Obama majored in political science.
He did?
Yes.
Okay.
What's that?
President Obama majored in political science. I was wondering the other day exactly what it was that he had studied in school.
So you can say that when Schaff isn't around, right?
Especially since he's my boss.
He's a good boss. Sometimes you have bad bosses. Sometimes you have good bosses.
Are we being recorded right now?
No.
I record his class too.
Oh man. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Getting started a little bit late. The material I have, I was hoping to have about 20 extra minutes at the end to do something a little different with Roosevelt than just lecture at you. We will see. I may still get through this material quickly enough that we will have some time at the end. I certainly hope so. Made the generalization last time that there is a general consensus about what figures and events of the 1920s and early 1930s are important, but no consensus at all on how to interpret some of these figures and events. And last time we talked about some of those events of the 1920s and early 1930s. And basically what I want you to concentrate on is that 1920 to 1932 period, not Roosevelt, who is also a controversial figure. He gets the whole question to himself. What's going on in that period that's controversial? Well, you could certainly talk about prohibition. Basic facts are clear enough, but how to interpret prohibition, that people disagree with all over the place. Even more substantial disagreement on some of the great trials and what they mean. What does the Sacco and Vanzetti trial show about America? Does it show that America is a prejudiced nation where people that are foreign-born, people that have unpopular political ideas do not possibly get a fair trial? Or does it suggest perhaps something about our intellectual classes and their attitudes toward ordinary, everyday Americans that's something dangerous as well? What about the Scopes trial? And once again, radically different interpretations of what it means. Very easy to find out exactly what the trial is about. You can actually go back to the original court transcript and know exactly what took place. But in terms of what that means as far as America is concerned, what it shows about America, again, this is one of the things that people are still arguing over to today. The significance of figures like, well, for some people, William Jennings Bryan is their hero. For some people, Clarence Darrow is their hero. Darrow's certainly one of the most famous defense lawyers of all time. These are still very influential men, and people take sides on these kinds of issues. Also, people take sides on the various presidents of this period. We talked last time about Warren G. Harding, sometimes called the worst of all American presidents, but there are many people, no, a minority, but there are people that will defend Harding, calling him a shrewd and effective president, a man who might have been very, very successful had it not been for the heart attack that took him out before he had completed even a full term in office. Likewise, Calvin Coolidge, very different opinions of Calvin Coolidge, and of course, very different opinions on the man that we are going to talk about first today, and that is Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover is one of the most controversial of all American presidents, and people are all over the map on this one when it comes to evaluating Hoover and his presidency. And of course, the main reason for that is the debates over the economies, economy that Hoover presided over. Hoover swept into office in 1912 28, elected in 1928, begins office in 1929. He was initially overwhelmingly popular. His slogan I mentioned to you last time, who but Hoover, but who spelled H-O-O, who but Hoover. And for many people, yes, who else? This man, 21 million votes to 15 million votes for his Democratic opponent, a third consecutive overwhelming popular vote victory for the Republicans. The Republicans, the conservative type, big business Republicans, looked like they were going to continue their dominance of American politics. As Hoover took over, American people were immensely confident that the future looked very good. And no wonder, the 1920s economy had been the best economy that any nation had seen all through history, and wonders appearing everywhere, the tremendous explosion of radios, motion pictures, automobiles, airplanes, everything going on. No wonder people were so optimistic in the 1920s. Outgoing President Calvin Coolidge, in his last State of the Union address, said, "No Congress of the United States ever assembled on surveying the State of the Union has met with a more pleasing prospect. The great wealth created by our enterprise and industry and saved by our economy has gone out in the widest possible distribution among our own people. Enlarging production is consumed by an increasing demand at home and expanded commerce abroad. The country can regard the present with satisfaction and anticipate the future with optimism." Wow, things are going to be great, says Coolidge. And certainly Herbert Hoover, as he takes Coolidge's place, as Hoover begins his term of office in 1929, Hoover says, "We in America, listen, we in America are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land. We have not reached the goal, but given a chance to go forward with the policies of the last 8 years, we shall soon, with the help of God, be in sight of the day when poverty will be banished from this nation." You know what? Hoover certainly looked like no fool when he said that. Most Americans would have shared that sentiment. Yes, we are on the right track. Everything is going well. And certainly the first few months of Hoover's administration, there was no indication that there were major problems on the horizon. Late October 1929, everything looked rosy. The stock market was jittery. October 24th, 1924, Black Thursday. Stocks fell drastically. They recovered somewhat, and then prices plummeted, and plummeted still more. Now, how important was all of this? This is one of the other things of the 1920s that's very, very controversial. How important was the stock market crash? In the minds of many people who lived through this period, the stock market crash was directly responsible for the Great Depression and the terrible economy that followed. In the minds of some, the stock market crash was a needed correction, not necessarily connected to the Great Depression. How can we figure out the connection between this stock market crash of 1929 and the terrible economy of the 1930s? And was there a connection? I think the first thing to address is why stocks were so high in the first place. The value of a share of stock, theoretically, reflects the value of whatever company you happen to own stock in. For instance, if you have a company worth $1 million, and you own 10% of the stock in that company, your stock value should be what? 10%, which is $100,000. That's easy. But the thing is, people pay more for a share of stock than it is worth. You're 10% of the company, you might be willing to pay more than 100. Now, why would somebody do that? Why would somebody pay? If the company's worth $1 million and you have 10% of the stock in that company, theoretically worth $100,000, why would you pay $150,000 or $200,000 for that stock? Why would you do that?
Speculation would go higher.
That is right. People anticipate take into account, when they invest in stocks, they take into account not only the current value of a company, but they take into account the potential for growth in that company. And so a stock price will reflect not just current value, but future value. A company may even be in debt, and not, you know, theoretically on paper, assets versus liabilities, the company may have a negative net worth. And yet the stock prices may be very high because people think, eventually, that company is on something, they are going to make a ton of money. One of the things that's very popular with investors, or was for a time, still is among some investors, is the IPO, the initial public offering of a stock. You get on the ground floor, and everybody hopes that the company you are investing in is going to be the next Apple, the next Microsoft, the next who knows what. And if you are lucky enough to get on the ground floor of a growing company, and look, in the 1920s, there were all sorts of these things that were springing up out of nowhere. You get on in on the ground floor, and you have a chance to have control a share of stock in a company that is growing and growing and growing, and no wonder people are willing to pay more. But something strange will often happen in the stock market. Not only will people pay more for a stock than the company is currently worth, sometimes there are occasions when people will pay more for a share of stock than that percentage of the company will ever be worth. Now, you can understand why somebody might pay, let's say, $100,000 for a share of stock in a company. Well, let's go back. You might pay $200,000 for 10% control of a company that's worth $1 million if you anticipate that that company is someday going to be worth $5 million and your 10% of that is going to be worth $500,000. You would do that, right? But would you ever do that if the company you were investing in could never, ever conceivably be worth more than the, let's say, $1 million? The value of the company is not going up. Would you pay $200,000 for 10% of a company that was never going to be worth more than $1 million? Would you do that? Oh, yes, you would. Because let us suppose that we have a share of stock or a block of shares. And Eric over here has a block of stocks to sell. Now that stock that Eric holds on to, worth $100,000. Okay, that's what it's worth. Cindy, what would you pay for that stock that's worth $100,000, and it's probably never going to be worth anymore? What would you pay for it? Maybe $100,000. But I'll tell you what, Matt here, he's a big speculator. Matt is likely to pay $150,000. Will you buy Eric's stock for $125,000 if you know Matt's going to buy it next week for $150,000?
Yeah.
You'll do that. And Matt, would you pay $150,000 for stock that's only worth $100,000? Would you do? Cindy's counting on you doing that. Are you going to do that? But look, Matt, Kilrayma is going to pay, she's a bigger speculator than you are. She's going to pay $175,000 for that stock. Would you do it? Buy it, $150,000? Yeah, okay. And would you're going to pay
$175,000? Do I hear two?
Right. Chelsea over there, she's big in the stock market. She'll pay $200,000 next week for the stock. You buy Matt's stock for $175,000 if you can sell it next week for $200,000? Yeah. Now, will you buy stock for $200,000? Now, remember that this stock is only worth $100,000. Will you pay $200,000 if you can sell it to Aaron for $250,000 next week? Okay, Aaron, will you pay $250,000 if you know that you can sell it to Kendra for $300,000 next week? Yeah. Kendra, will you buy that if you can sell it to Trevor for $350,000? $350,000, okay. Trevor, will you buy that? Eric's trying to get back into that business. Will you buy it for $350,000 if you know he's going to pay you $400,000 for it?
I think so.
You think so?
Yeah.
And Eric, you're going to buy it for $400,000?
I don't know, I'm busted.
Oh! And this is something that very often happens in speculative markets, is there will be a bubble. People will bid something up, and you will buy it, and you know in the back of your mind that it's really not worth what you're going to pay what you're paying for it, but because you know that some other idiot is going to pay it even more than you are going to pay for it, you certainly do, because it's going up and up and it never seems like it's going to come down. And there's a weird psychology, and you probably have heard of this. There was a tulip bubble in Holland where people were buying up tulip bulbs and paying sky high prices. And why would they do this? Because they could sell it and sell it and sell it. South Sea bubble, this is in the British Isles. South Sea bubble practically destroyed the British economy at one point. And more recently in this country, you look at the housing market in California, and people were paying $800,000 for cracker box houses. Insane. And yet you would do it because you were always sure somebody else will buy it. Hey, and I can live in the house in the meantime, right? You get these bubbles. But there's something that can aggravate this even more. Let's suppose you are in a situation where you can put down a small percentage of the value of the stock to control that stock at some later time. You can do what's called buying on the margin. Buying on the margin means you put down a small sum for your stock, and then you are in control of those shares. Now let's talk about how this might work. Let's start with a small amount of money. Let's suppose, because after all, none of us are wealthy, let's start with $100. Now let's suppose the rules of the stock market allow you to buy on the margin, and you can use your $100 to control $1,000 worth of stock. Okay, so you put down your $100, you control your $1,000 worth of stock. Sometime in the future, you're going to have to pay the remaining price of that stock. You're going to have to pay somebody $900. In the meantime, the stock that you have bought goes up in value. It goes up to $1,500. All right, you're controlling that stock. You sell it. You get $1,500 from the sale of stock that you paid $100 on the margin for. You have to pay off the rest of your debt. The rest of your debt is how much? $900. You pay off your $900 plus your initial $100 investment, and how much you have in your pocket? $500. And so your $100 investment has earned you what? $500. Boy, where can you get a 500? And this might take place in a matter of weeks or months in a red hot stock market. A stock can easily go from $1,000 to $1,500 when there are all these speculators in the market. So you put down $100, now you got $500 to work with. Well, stock market rules, $500 lets you buy on the margin, and now, well, 10%, this is 10% of what? 10% of 5,000. Now you got 5,000. You control $5,000 worth of stock with your $500 to invest. Okay, now your $5,000 investment, this company goes up, and let's say, oh, this is red hot. You really picked the company this time. The stock goes to $10,000. Now, you paid initially $500 for that. You owe, what, $4,500, and there's your initial $500 investment, and you've sold your stock for $10,000. You pay off your debt and your initial $500 investment, and what are you left with? You're left with what?
$5,000.
Whoa, hey, we have just turned, with two transactions, we've turned $100 in initial investment into $5,000. That's pretty good. That'll pay for a semester at Northern. Not bad. We can do better. $5,000. All right, $5,000 is 10% of what?
$50,000.
$50,000, right? Well, what did I say? 5,000, yeah, 5,000 is 10% of 50,000, it's 10% of 50,000. Now we control $50,000 worth of stock. That stock, we don't go quite so well, but we do pretty well. And the value of the stock goes to $75,000 in a matter of weeks or months. And now we sell our stock. Now we put down $5,000, our initial investment. We've sold our stock for $75,000. We have to pay off the remainder, which is $45,000. And now, $75,000 that we've made selling that stock,
50,000, what are we left with? $25,000. Three transactions! And in a red hot stock market, this kind of thing is possible. I'll talk to you later about Hillary Clinton turning $2,000 into $200,000 in a matter of months. Can be done. And everybody's making money. Everybody's making money. Because this, you know, the stocks just go up and up and up and up. But, wait a minute. Let's suppose people start realizing the price is too high. The stock value is worth way more than these companies are going to be worth. And let's suppose that last investment of yours, instead of your stock going up in value to $75,000, we correct that a little bit. And the stock goes down to 40,000, okay, in value. Well, you've had your initial $5,000 investment, and you pay off your $45,000, and we subtract 50,000 from 40,000, and you're left with a profit of?
Negative
$10,000. And remember, you started with an investment of what?
$100.
You have a wonderful source of income that's going to allow you to pay $10,000 worth of debt?
Nope.
And remember, the $10,000 worth of debt is going to be like 20 times the annual salary of a working class person. Now, most of these investors are going to be more well-to-do than that, but many of them are going to be working class people. Right? All of a sudden, you're $10,000 in debt. And you're $10,000 in debt, and what happens? There goes the car. There goes the house. There goes you to the poorhouse. Right? Because you've all of a sudden acquired for yourself debt that you cannot possibly pay. Buying on the margin is a game for those that can afford extraordinary risk. And in the 1920s, those people that were buying on the margin were not people, necessarily, that could afford these extraordinary risks. And when the bill came due, when the stock market crashes, you got lots and lots of people who on paper had made themselves into millionaires, and now all of a sudden, they're worthless. Well, they're not really worthless, but they consider themselves worthless. And when you have lost your money and when you have your ego into this, oh, I'm a millionaire, and all of a sudden, instead of being a millionaire, we got nothing. What do you do? You go jump out a window. Some people. If their self-worth is tied up in monetary gain, and if they are looking forward to, and some of them enjoying a lavish, you know, fairly lavish lifestyle, and all of a sudden they got nothing, they got to live like a university professor.
Yeah.
Or even worse, you got to live like a college student. Man! Can you imagine that? Living like a college student for the rest of your life. Actually, that's a good life. There is no better life than college. That's why I'm still here. I love it. Poor or not, it's a good life. Graduate school is fun. We have no money. What a wonderful years. Three kids, no money. Wonderful life anyway. Let's see, what am I talking about?
Still paying off student loans?
What?
Still paying off student loans?
No. Our student loans, 10 years. There was a grace period of 6 months, and then you had 10 years to pay them off. So my student loans got paid. I've been here 23 years now. My student loans got paid off about 11 or 12 years ago. Just in time for my own kids.
Financing isn't as good these days.
What?
Well, you know, with all the cuts that the government is making. Yeah.
I hate even ask the question, but your best subsidized student loans, what is the interest rate on those?
I think it's 6%.
Oh, that's not terrible.
Mine's 4% this year. They dropped the percent.
Oh, did they? Well, that's not terrible. But, yeah. For a while, students were paying. Well, it depends on your student loan, but on many of those loans, when interest rates were real high, you know,
8, 10, 12% on student loans is terrible. Some of those. What? You're trying to get me off on a sidetrack.
Sorry.
That's all right. What's worse than the student loans is the student credit cards and the students that, that graduate not only with student loan debt, but with huge amounts of credit card debt.
Because that's like 22%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not only that, you have to start paying, you know, it's accumulating immediately. Absolutely the worst way to finance an education is to put it on your credit card. All right, what happens? Stock market crashes. Personal tragedies, people committing suicide, people losing their fortunes. But did the Great Depression have to fall? Hoover said it. Hoover said that the economy was fundamentally sound. But was the economy fundamentally sound? I think not entirely. Now here I am on very dangerous ground. I often bring in Dr. Newman at this point to talk about this with students, but the economists themselves, even the best economists, disagree on this. You will see article after article after article in publications today by prominent economists, sometimes Nobel Prize winning economists, and they do not agree. They just do not agree. You get two economists in the same room and they'll have three different opinions on the stock market crash. Nevertheless, let me give you my sense of the 1920s economy, realizing this is a historian's very amateur view of economics rather than an economist's more specific view. Mellon, Andrew Mellon's policy. Remember, Andrew Mellon, the only Secretary of the Treasury to have three presidents serve under him. Harding, Secretary of the Treasury, Coolidge, Secretary of the Treasury, and now Herbert Hoover, Secretary of the Treasury. What had been Andrew Mellon's policy all along? Andrew Mellon's policy, as Matt noticed, very much like the trickle-down economics that, or supply-side economics that Reagan would advocate later. Mellon says, cut income tax rates on the wealthy. What will happen is that the wealthy will use the extra income, they will invest it, the economy will boom, and the government, even though it is taxing at a lower rate, will turn out to have more in income in the long run rather than less. That was the basic Andrew Mellon policy. And as I told you before, in a certain sense, that policy of Andrew Mellon seemed to work. In fact, 99% of the time in human history, and I can't even think of a single example where something like Mellon's policy doesn't work. You lower taxes, it does stimulate the economy. As the economy gets better, government resources do go up. In general, that part of the policy does seem to be effective. But that was not all of Mellon's policies. The idea of cutting taxes to stimulate the economy, making the economy better off, increasing government revenue, that part of it doesn't seem to me to be where the problem lies. The problem lies in what happens as a result. Businessmen did have more money to invest. And what theoretically should happen at that point is they invest their money, they make more efficient factories, more efficient businesses, or whatever. As business becomes more efficient, as the average worker can produce more, wages should go up and prices should come down. That's what should happen with increased efficiency. But what was not happening in the 1920s is now, the factories were getting, the businessmen were putting lots and lots of money into factories and other kinds of investments. The investments were made, efficiency was going up, and you can see that in things like the automobile industry and the tremendous explosion of the electronics industry and all of that. Efficiency was getting better, but wages were not going up, and prices were not coming down. Why? Why? And here it seems to me is a clue to what may have gone wrong, and I really have to qualify this, I am not an economist, but what may have gone wrong here, and what seems to me historically to have gone wrong, is that there was no competition. For laissez-faire economics to work, for free enterprise economics to work, you absolutely need competition. And what had begun to happen once again in the 1920s is that the trusts began to grow again.
We will remember that Teddy Roosevelt, to a certain extent, was a trust buster. Taft, to a larger extent, was a trust buster. Woodrow Wilson, I didn't really mention this, but Woodrow Wilson was certainly a trust buster. But now, under Harding and under Coolidge, the trusts start growing again. And when the trusts are going again, what happens? There's no competition. Prices stay high. Something else that keeps prices high. Sure, income tax rates go down, but what goes up? I mentioned this to you last time. What tax goes up? The tariff goes up. And you see, it's not truly a tax cut if you are raising other taxes to lower taxes in a different area. This is not truly laissez-faire economics, okay? And you always have to watch the people that advocate tax cuts. Are they saying tax cuts and really all they mean is a transfer? And that is what happened in the 1920s economy. Yes, certain kinds of people were paying less in taxes, but other people were paying more as the tariff goes up. As the tariff goes up, who is paying that tariff?
Consumers,
and in particular, farmers, right? Because the farmers, they are paying higher prices for manufactured goods than they would have to pay if there weren't these high tariffs, okay? So that's part of what's going on. Now, wait. Workers aren't being paid more. Prices are staying high. Wait a minute, you got a problem. Because if workers' wages aren't going up and prices are high, who's going to buy all of these goods produced by America's factories? You say nobody?
The rich.
Oh, wrong. Oh, no. Well, the rich are going to buy it by somebody. But who is going to? Here's the trick. How do you get demand to stay high when prices are high and wages are not going up? What do you encourage people to do? That would be nice to continue to expand your markets overseas. Yeah, you could sure try that.
Buy on credit?
Andrew Mellon deliberately embraced policies that would keep interest rates artificially low. So that people would buy on credit. And this is something that expands dramatically in the 1920s, is debt on every level, but particularly large levels of consumer debt. But also, you got, as you're building these factories and things like that, it's not all financed by selling your stock. There is debt at every level. America is, well, it's mortgaged to the hilt. Now, if you anticipate that the economy is going to get better and better and better and better, and America's going to be more and more prosperous, of course you do. And for a long time, students were willing to accept very, very high student loan debt. Why? Because you graduated with a college degree, and you graduated with a college degree in the red hot 1990s or the early, what are we calling the 2000 to 2000? Are we calling that the aughts? What are we calling that 2000 to 2010 period? Do we have a name for it yet? No. Not yet. Whatever, you graduated with a college degree in that period, red hot. I was getting a lot of students who were walking into jobs that paid better than I was getting paid here, particularly if they were willing to relocate to California or Arizona or New Mexico. Of course students would accept high student loan debt. It didn't matter. They could pay it off.
Students a little bit more worried about that now. Mm-hmm. Amen.
Colleges play a terrible game. Whenever the economy's bad, colleges tell students,
oh yeah, it's bad now. But in 4 years, when you get your degree, you tell freshmen, in 4 years when you get your degree, economy's gonna be real good and you're sure to get a job.
Nobody's got a crystal ball, nobody knows.
There's some speculation that we're experiencing like an education bubble now.
Oh, absolutely.
There is no question about that. We are. And the way people are going to address that, we could get off on a real tangent here, but the way people are going to address that is likely to destroy education, higher education, if we haven't been enough to destroy it.
Matt, we need to talk about that issue, but in a later context, because there are some changes to higher education that have not taken place in the 1920s. In any case, we got a big, big explosion in debt. Now let's suppose you're a business owner, and all of a sudden, you have debts that are going to be very hard to pay. Some of your best customers were heavily invested in the stock market. They lost everything they had, and they're no longer your customers. And maybe they're some of the people that jumped out of buildings because they couldn't pay their debts. And your customers go away, and your revenue is shrinking, and you got debts of your own, and you gotta, what do you gotta do? You gotta figure out a way to cut expenses, right? Yeah? All right? Well, let's lay off our machines. Machines don't have families to support. Let's lay off our machines. Can't lay off machines? Why not? Can't lay off machines, so what do you do? Can't lay off buildings. What do you do? Where's the only place typically that you can cut expenses if you're a business owner? Almost always. That's the place that's going to take the majority of the cut. You start firing employees, and you start with the least productive, but pretty soon you get to the point where you're cutting some of your most productive workers, because that's the only place you can cut. Well, now people are out of work. If people don't have jobs, and they're already mortgaged to the hilt, what do? They cut back on their spending, right? Finally, at our level, you wake up and you quit spending. Now, the government doesn't do that. The government keeps spending long beyond its limits. But us, you already got as much debt as you can handle. You don't have a job. You start eating mac and cheese and hot dogs for dinner. Well, that's what I'm doing already. Well, yeah, I don't know. What do you eat? Raw men. There we go. Yeah, we ate raw men when I was in college forever. 13 and a half years of college. I still like raw men. My kids got tired of it. I had a book. I'm off on a tangent. I had a book. It was a wonderful book. I still have it. The Impoverished Student's Guide to Eating. And it taught you how to eat well on very little per meal. And it's a good book. It's a good, very useful book. A little thin book. One of the most useful books.
Ketchup soup in there?
What?
Ketchup soup in there?
I don't think so. Have you ketchup soup? Huh?
Yeah, you see Ted Seaton, ask him sometime about ketchup soup.
All right. I will.
He hitchhiked for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so he would go into places and just get hot water and ketchup. Didn't have to pay anything for it then.
Huh? Ketchup soup. All right, never mind. So, by 1930, 4 million unemployed workers, the country in the midst of a full-scale depression. Enter the man who Calvin Coolidge had called the Wonder Boy. Now, Coolidge was sarcastic. Coolidge called Hoover the Wonder Boy. He was not all impressed. Hoover was very, very different from Coolidge in personality. But Franklin Roosevelt called Hoover a wonder quite sincerely. But in any case, the Wonder Boy, Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover, immensely controversial figure of the 1920-1932 period. To some people, Hoover is the arch villain, the man chiefly responsible for the Depression. Contemporaries called it the Hoover Depression. They gave the president's name to the Depression. And some people say that Hoover created this depression, how? By continuing the failed laissez-faire economic principles of his Republican predecessors, Harding and Coolidge. But There are other people who say, no, no, that's unfair. Hoover was simply unlucky. He faced economic circumstances that no one would have been able to figure out how to deal with. This was a correction to the economy. We were in a bubble, and it really isn't Hoover's fault. And there are other people that say that Hoover did in fact create the Depression, but not the way that some of Hoover's critics claim. He didn't create the Depression, or not create, but he didn't aggravate the Depression by continuing laissez-faire policies of Harding and Coolidge. The mistake that Hoover made was trying to fix the economy through government intervention, a practice that, in the minds of some people, invariably makes things worse rather than better. Remember Harding in 1920, facing a depression, potential depression. What had Harding done? Harding had done nothing, just allowed the economy to take its course, and the American economy was soon humming again. And there are some people that argue this is the mistake that Hoover made. So, three different interpretations of Hoover, or three, actually many more. But one, he made the Depression bad by continuing too many of the policies of Harding and Coolidge. Two, he isn't responsible for the Depression. He's caught circumstances beyond his control. And three, his mistake was not continuing laissez-faire economic policies, but trying to get the government to fix what was wrong with the economy. And I'll let you sort out what you think of this. I'll give you some factual information and some information on both sides. Capable man. Was Hoover a capable man? Certainly so. Herbert Hoover, a poor Iowa farm boy, orphaned at an early age, but he worked hard. He worked his way through Stanford, picked up an engineering degree there, and let me tell you, the engineering program at Stanford, today it's incredibly rigorous, but in the 1920s too, it was one of the finest engineering programs anywhere. Hoover had real practical skills. He used his engineering skills all around the world, particularly in the mining industry. He went to Russia, other places. Very, very impressive. He became a millionaire, not through speculation, but really by good techniques, improving things all. I really like engineers. Engineers look at problems and solve them, and Hoover has that engineering mindset, and certainly earned the millions that he made for himself. All right, a tangent. Hoover went to Stanford. He was the manager of the football team at Stanford. In the Rose Bowl of whatever year it was, when he was the manager of the football team manager was responsible for equipment, and Hoover forgot to bring the football to the Rose Bowl game. Okay, just a bit of trivia, the kind of thing that Eric likes to read was trivia books, that Hoover forgot to bring the football to the anyway, Hoover, after World War I, directed relief efforts in Europe. And Hoover did a splendid job. Europe was facing a humanitarian disaster after all the destruction. There is no question that Hoover saved millions of lives by figuring out how to deal with absolutely chaotic conditions. In fact, it would have seemed from his background that Hoover would be the ideal person to deal with problems of a significant magnitude. America, he already showed that he could do this. He'd already showed that engineering mindset, at least in a certain set of circumstances, could work very, very well. As I say, he had saved millions of lives in Europe. It's no wonder that Franklin Roosevelt said that you could not ask for a better president. Yes, Franklin Roosevelt, when Hoover was initially elected, told the American people, you could not ask for a better president. Now, Roosevelt is a Democrat, a committed Democrat, working very hard for Al Smith and some of the other Democratic nominees of that time, and yet even Roosevelt says, this is the man that we would want as president. Well, back to 1930. What is Hoover going to do? Is he going to adopt the same policies as Harding, that is, do nothing, just let the Depression run its course? But no. Hoover has that engineer's mindset. Every problem that presents itself is a problem to be solved. And so Hoover initially has to come up with a plan. with the assistance, of course, of Andrew Mellon. Now, let's suppose you go to Andrew Mellon, and Andrew, you ask, hey, Mr. Mellon, what do you think we ought to do to stimulate the economy, get the country going again? What do you think Mellon's first response is going to be?
Nothing.
Oh, no, not nothing.
Lower the taxes.
Ah, there we go. Cindy, yeah. this was a very good guess, but
yeah.
Lower taxes, right?
This isn't
right? Yeah. Lower what kind of taxes?
On the wealthy?
Income taxes on the wealthy. Because, yes, if we cut taxes on the wealthy, they'll have more money to invest and they'll put everybody back to work. Great. What else do you think Mellon is going to say? How else do you stimulate the economy? What had he done before?
Raised tariffs.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But then what's the other way to get the economy moving? Get people to buy stuff, right? How do you get people to buy stuff?
Lowering prices.
Mm-hmm. Lower interest rates, encouraging more credit, right? And now, the other thing, the tariff. Now, this isn't really Mellon's baby, and it's not really Hoover's. But there was a strong, strong desire among certain American businesses to see the tariff go up. Why? We get a protective tariff, and people will buy American. They'll buy at home, and they buy at home. Our factories will be operative, and Americans will have jobs and all of that. And so what Hoover ended up signing into law is what is called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff that I'm sure all of you heard about back in your high school class. Now we have a 60% tariff on imported goods. The tariff almost worse than ever before. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff, and what? Makes sense, doesn't it? Put this high tariff on imported goods and then Americans will buy from American factories and American workers will have jobs. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? It seems to. Made sense to Congress. Hoover should have known better. Signed it into law. But what happens? When America passes a tariff like this, a 60% tariff on imported goods, what's going to happen?
Other countries are going to see that and do the same to us.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. A bunch of retaliatory tariffs, and what happens? America, all of a sudden, loses its overseas ability to compete overseas. And so instead of more jobs and more demand for American goods, there's less. And it's not just America. We end up with a worldwide depression, in part because of this kind of short sight. Now, America is not solely to blame. But the American economy is such a large player in the world economy that there is a ripple effect. As America goes to protectionism, the rest of the world goes to protectionism, and the worldwide economy suffers during this period. All right, that's what you try first. You go to Andrew Mellon for advice. You go to your traditional business conservatives who want lower income tax rates, higher tariff, inflated credit. That's not working. So what do? Next, and remember, Hoover's an engineer. He's got to try something until it works. So he comes up with a different idea. Under Hoover, we get the RFC, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. RFC, a lot of money spent by the government to do what? To bail out the banks, to bail out the insurance companies, to bail out state and local governments that don't have enough revenue. And also, the RFC bankrolls massive public works programs. The construction of what eventually comes to be called Hoover Dam is an example. See, that's a way to put people back to work. All these construction kinds of projects, right? And if people have jobs building these massive public works programs, well, they'll spend their money and the rest of the economy will be stimulated as well. What's the result? Here is a question that I cannot possibly answer for you. I have a feeling on this, but not an answer. There are some people that say that Hoover's big mistake was that he should have left well enough alone, and the country would have recovered. The RFC actually aggravated the problems here. There are other people that say, no, no, Hoover was headed in the right direction, he simply didn't do enough. But whatever is the right answer to that question, it didn't work. Unemployment went from 3.2% to 24.9%, almost a quarter of Americans out of work. Landlords couldn't collect rents from people who didn't have money to pay, and so landlords couldn't pay their taxes. And so, since you couldn't pay your property taxes, that meant a major source of local revenue was gone. No money for government services, schools closed. 1,500 universities closed during that period. And Matt was talking about the bubble in higher education. That's probably the answer to the bubble, much as I hate to say it. That's probably around the corner, is the closing of many, many universities. Because we're inefficient. We're way over capacity. We've done dumb things. I mean, here in South Dakota, we've spent millions of dollars enlarging SDSU, enlarging the capacity of SDSU, while you have other campuses that are under-enrolled. Dakota State is becoming, you know, Dakota State is keeping students in Sioux Falls, but the actual campus is becoming kind of almost a ghost town. Mm-hmm. What sense did it make to expand SDSU when you were under capacity of river institutions? I mean, that's why your tax, you know, that's why your tuition dollars are going up, is because the people making these decisions will. I'm sorry. Tangent again. You know the football coach at the University of Texas is being paid?
Oh, no, very much.
What?
Ridiculous.
More than $1 million a year for the football coaches. And I used to think, I was an athletic director, I really love sports, and I think it used to be that sports paid, men's football and men's basketball paid for the entirety of your athletic budget. Sports programs put you in the black. We've hit a situation where of the top level of NCAA competition, you know how many schools are making money? 16 of 100 made money, up from 12 last year. And the losses in Division I athletics are staggering. Paid for by what? Paid for by your tuition dollars.
You even look at, like, in Texas high school football coaches, mm-hmm. It's astronomical.
Yeah. But, you know, as I say, I love sports. But somehow we've made weird, weird, weird decisions. Anyway, universities are closing, book sales fall, obviously. You don't buy books when your kids are hungry. Who got the blame?
Hoover Hoover.
And with them, the Republicans. 1932 election. Promised great things for the Democrats. Now remember, the Democrats have only held the White House for two terms under Cleveland, two terms under Wilson, since the Civil War. For a long, long time there. The Democrats are going to have a chance if they can come up with the right kind of candidate. Well, we'll take a break. Give me 5 minutes, we'll come back, and we'll talk about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And there is no way I'm going to have the 20 minutes extra that I thought that I was going to have at the end of this class, and I may even actually have to finish up with Roosevelt on Monday. But whatever. Take a break. Sorry about all the changes.
No, you're not. You give us extra information.
Yeah. Yeah, useless information. Oh. And you will probably remember that. None of you are going to forget that Hoover forgot the football for the Rose Bowl game.